And let's take a look next at our daily business bottom line. In the publishing world, a big part of the bottom line is who takes the financial risk up front. A publisher takes a chance that a book will sell, pays the author in advance, occasionally a big one, pays to design and print up copies, pays to distribute them to bookstores or online. But there have always been people who self-publish, pay for the book themselves. Used to be derided as the vanity press for writers who couldn't interest a publisher but still burned to see themselves in print. But thanks to e-books, self-publishing has exploded, and a handful of writers have had huge bestsellers, which explains why the big publisher, Simon & Schuster, decided to launch its own self-publishing company. Here's NPR's Lynn Neary.
Alan Sepinwall's self-published book, The Revolution Was Televised, came out just before Thanksgiving. Within 2 weeks, he had a review in the New York Times, a positive review by the widely read and often critical Michiko Kakutani, who also named it one of her favorite books of the year. This is what book publicists and their writers dream of, and Sepinwall didn't even see it coming.
I was sitting at my computer on the Monday, the day before it ran, recording my podcast, and all of a sudden I see an email from a Times photo editor saying, "Hi, the Times will be running a review of your book tomorrow. We need an author photo. Can you help us?"
Turns out Kakutani is a fan of Sepinwall's popular TV blog on the HitFix site. Her review has helped boost sales of Sepinwall's book. That doesn't happen to most self-published writers. Hannah Brooks Olson was happy just to see a published version of her book, Hanged Man's Leap.
It was so exciting. It was way more exciting than I thought it was going to be. I immediately told any of my friends who I knew had e-readers, and I obviously emailed my mother, too, with a link.
Brooks Olson wrote about her self-publishing experience for the online magazine Lit Reactor. She got editing help from her parents, and her boyfriend designed the cover, but otherwise she did it all herself. E-publishing is the quickest way to go, and Brooks Olson chose Kindle Direct because it seemed easy to use, and she liked having the power of Amazon behind her.
And it does sort of get sold randomly at times. I'll get a direct deposit from Amazon every now and then for, you know, $10 or $15. I'm like, oh, I must have sold a couple more that month.
But the process was not problem-free. There were formatting issues, and she had to wade through a lot of legalese to figure out the contract with Amazon, especially royalties. She viewed the process as an experiment, but says if you're more serious about selling a book, you might want some help.
Have you written a book that you dream of publishing? Every day, we help people just like you publish the book of their dreams and sell it from online stores like Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com.
Do a quick search of the internet, and you'll find lots of help for writers who want to self-publish, from companies like Smashwords, which publishes and distributes e-books, to companies like Lulu, which publishes both electronic and print books and offers a range of services that cost up to $5,000.
It's everything from, you know, website design to social media strategies to cover design, you know, to editing packages.
Lulu Marketing Director Brian Matthews. Lulu's been around since 2002, long before the current self-publishing boom. Matthews says a lot of Lulu's customers just want to print a few copies of the book for families or friends. But others have seen all the self-publishing success stories and think they can duplicate that.
Obviously, when you get into hundreds of thousands of titles and there's hundreds to thousands of real successes in a given year, the percentages are small, but in the democratized world of self-publishing, there are very low barriers. And if someone is, you know, has a good story to tell, is able to tap into a community and interested set of readers, certainly we've seen again and again, they can find that success.
It may seem that self-publishing companies are taking advantage of writers with little hope of making their money back. But even a writer with a fighting chance of self-publishing success, like Alan Sepinwall, needs some help. Sepinwall hired a professional editor and has his own very popular blog as a publicity platform. But Sepinwall wasn't so sure about designing and formatting the book himself.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a writer. I'm not a layout guy. I'm not an artist. So I could have come up with something on my own, but it would have looked amateurish in some way. And so I figured, all right, I'm going to stick to my strengths and I will bring in other people to help me.
A friend recommended a company called 52 Novels to help design and format the book. All in all, Sepinwall spent about $2,500 on self-publishing, which at the time seemed like a lot of money.
I turned down this offer from the one publisher a year ago because I thought it wasn't what I was hoping for, and also I didn't get the sense that maybe they were that enthusiastic about the book anyway. And for a while when I was going through this whole self-publishing odyssey, I kept sort of saying to myself, what a mistake. What did you do? That was money in the bank. You're never going to make that much selling it on your own. I've already made quite a bit more than that.
The audience has been growing by leaps and bounds, and there have been more and more signal successes in that world.
Carolyn Reedy is the CEO of Simon & Schuster, which recently announced it is launching a new self-publishing service in partnership with Authors Solutions, Inc. If traditional publishers want to survive, Reedy says, they have to keep up with the rapid changes taking place in the industry. The growth of self-publishing is one of them.
We actually understand that it is a different world than what we do, and we want to understand it. And if it is going to or possibly could be a threat to our business, we definitely want to understand it and also see how we can turn that to our advantage. And one of the advantages is it is a great way to find authors, also new genres and new audiences.
The company, Archway, will also offer a range of publishing packages to would-be authors. But Reedy says no one from Simon & Schuster will be directly involved in publishing or editing Archway books. However, Simon & Schuster will keep track of sales.
And one of the advantages to actually having this relationship as opposed to merely watching the self-publishing authors published by others is that we will begin to see sales velocity and other things like that earlier in the game. So we saw it as an advantage to us in finding talent. Hopefully that is an advantage to the authors, but they are not being published by Simon & Schuster.
And that's an important point, because while self-publishing may be all the rage right now, the truth is the ultimate goal for a lot of writers is a contract with a traditional publishing company. Alan Sepinwall is already considering that possibility.
It would put it in brick-and-mortar stores. It would put it in college bookstores. It would put it in other places. It would make it more widely available to people, and I think that would be nice. It depends on sort of what deal would be presented to me to make it worth giving up the rights to it, which I have right now.
And you have the total rights, so all the money comes right to you.
It is my book. There is no one else involved. The formatting company, that's work for hire. Cover artist, copy editor, all of that was work for hire. This is my book.
And he can do with it what he wants. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It's time now for NPR's Backseat Book Club, when we put 9 to 14-year-olds in the driver's seat. We ask them to read our monthly selection and then send in their questions for the author. This month's book is The Red Pyramid by Rick Riordan. Our colleague Michelle Norris leads us on this reading adventure.
If there was a recipe for the best-selling writer Rick Riordan, it would go something like this. Start with a love of storytelling. Fold in more than a decade of teaching middle school English. Combine that with two sons of his own who don't quite share their dad's love of literature, and marinate all that with a deep passion for mythology. Rick Riordan has sold tens of millions of kids' books. He hit pay dirt with the Percy Jackson series. It's about an everyday kid who has superhero powers because he's the secret son of Poseidon, the Greek god of the sea. Egyptian gods reign supreme in our latest book for backseat readers. It's The Red Pyramid from Riordan's Kane Chronicles. He gives us a quick sketch of the plot.
The Red Pyramid is about a brother and sister, Carter and Sadie Kane, who have lived apart most of their lives. One Christmas Eve, their father brings them both together for a trip to the British Museum, and a terrible magical accident happens that unleashes the gods of ancient Egypt into the modern world. Carter and Sadie find out that they are descended from ancient Egyptian magicians, and they are the only ones who have the magic that might be able to put the gods back where they belong before the world spirals out of control.
Now, Rick Riordan is an author who knows his audience.
I imagine myself in front of my own class. I don't teach anymore, but I can still clearly see fifth period after lunch. That's a real tough time to teach. And I tried to imagine writing a story that would appeal to those kids, even when they're tired, even when they're bouncing off the walls, something that would be so engaging, so fitting for their sense of humor, for their sensibility, for how they saw the world, the sort of crazy absurdity of it all, but also the action, the engaging characters, the emotions that they could relate to. If I could find a way to tell a story that would resonate with them, then I had something going.
Here at the Backseat Book Club, we love to hear from our young readers. And for this book, we had a motherload of emails from India to England to Mapleton, Georgia. Here's 9-year-old Elliot Bemis.
I loved reading The Red Pyramid. I did a themed project in my class and made a time machine to go back to ancient Egypt. Once I was there, I taught my classmates about the gods and goddesses. It was awesome. I have a question for you. How did you choose the numbers 13, 32, 33? Do they have some special meaning? Thank you for writing such an amazing book. Keep writing.
Wow, what a great project. I'd love to see the time machine. That sounds fantastic. The numbers actually are Carter's favorite players from the L.A. Lakers. So, you know, I'd like to say they have some great magical significance, but really it's all about basketball. And being from San Antonio myself, I had to be a little careful about the L.A. Lakers reference, but I decided to risk it.
Carter and Sadie are biracial kids, and right. Yet you don't make a lot of that in the book. And in talking to teachers, that's one thing that they in particular really like about this.
The idea of kids being caught between two worlds is something I think that always fascinates me and that resonates with my students as well, my readers. I think anytime you're writing to the middle grades, you're writing to young readers who are trapped in a number of ways between two worlds, between childhood and adulthood, between their friends and their parents, and often they're trapped trying to identify where they fit in their culture. With Egypt especially, that becomes a very powerful metaphor because Egypt really is a crossroads of the ancient world. It's part of the European tradition and culture, but it's also very much part of the African tradition and culture, and it sort of belongs in both worlds. It's really the deepest taproot of what I would say is our modern Western civilization. So in a way, I was using Carter and Sadie to sort of explore that idea of being between cultures and trying to decide where you fit. Who are you? Because learning to self-identify is really important to the kids of the age that I'm writing to.
And, I'm hearing metaphors on top of metaphors, next to metaphors, sliding into metaphors, because there's also the two worlds that you write about in terms of the ancient and the modern culture.
Absolutely. I think one thing I'm always trying to do in my books is find the universal. Even if these stories are 3,000 years old, there are still so much about the characters, about the dilemmas, about their understanding of the universe that still resonates. The whole idea of order and chaos, which is really central to the ancient Egyptian understanding of the world, is still very much with us. You know, how much order is good, and when does order become too restrictive? Is a little bit of chaos okay, or is chaos always an evil force? I mean, these are questions that any kid who's ever been in a school cafeteria can relate to.
We received a letter from Lindsay LeMay, and it's a bit long, but I just bear with me because it's worth hearing.
I am now 16, and all I can say is thank you. Thank you for all the books that helped make me the person I am today. Don't worry, I turned out okay, or so they tell me. I would not be who I am today if it weren't for the inspiration you put in your books. They inspire me to do my best. And when that isn't good enough, to push harder. They motivate me to be loyal to my friends and to stand up for the truth. When someone tells me I can't do something because of some fault I have, your books inspire me to want to do it more. So thanks again for the inspiration and making us, your fans, realize that there is a hero in every one of us, even an ADHD, dyslexic, annoying, seaweed-brained kid. Sincerely, Lindsay.
Wow, what a letter. You know, when I hear a letter like that, I think to myself, okay, you know, I'm good now. I've done what I set out to do. I don't know that it gets any better. So thank you, Lindsay. That's amazing. And I'm really glad that the books have been such a great positive influence on you. That's really the biggest reward that I can have as a teacher or as a writer.
Riordan's kids' books began with bedtime stories for his two sons. They didn't inherit his obsession with books, but the kids did share their dad's love for the ancient world. So he spun tales about mythological gods whose worlds collided with ordinary kids, kids who had to stare down their fears to do heroic things. Riordan wants that message to his sons to be embraced by all kids, including those who are out there listening to their radios right now. By the way, Rick Riordan's not done yet. Next up, Norse gods. I'm Michelle Norris, NPR News.
Next up, it's 1968, and 8th grader Doug is new to town trying to find his place. Gary Schmidt's novel, OK for Now. Send your questions to backseatbookclub@npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
When you think of Rod Stewart, you think raspy vocals, that hair, and maybe this song.
Wake up, Maggie, I think I got something to say to you.
Maggie May came out in 1971, and it quickly flew up to the top of the pop music charts in the UK, and it became Stewart's first breakout hit in the US. Since then, the Grammy Award-winning singer has enjoyed one of the longest careers in pop music. He's released dozens of albums. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a solo artist in 1994, and again this year as a member of the 70s British band The Faces. So what musical milestone was left for Stewart? Well, a Christmas album, of course. More about that in a moment. He's also written an autobiography. The book traces Stewart's musical roots back to his childhood in North London and a family that encouraged him to dream big.
Very, very close, very loving. Very helpful, very supportive family.
When you think about where you came from, can you identify a person who helped put you on the path?
In the early days, it would have been my dad who bought me a guitar for no apparent reason when I wanted a station for my railway set. And also, the guy who discovered me was a guy called Long John Baldry, who discovered me singing on a railway station way back in the 60s and asked me to join his band.
Up above my head, up above my head, I hear music in the air,
I hear music in the air,
up above my head,
up above my head, I hear music in the air.
You write in your book about the first time you came to the United States. You were with the Jeff Beck Group at the time. You were quite nervous in this setting.
I was a white boy from North London trying to sing rhythm and blues and soul music. I was paranoid that the curtain would go back and it would be all full of black people and they'd shout out, oh, fraud, 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 fraud. But it wasn't, and they accepted me. And, you know, James Brown once said I was the greatest white soul singer ever.
That's pretty high praise.
Yeah, my man James.
Help me love you, baby. You're driving my poor heart.
I want to talk about your image over the years. You dedicate an entire chapter in your book to your hair.
Well, it was, the hairstyle was around a lot longer than my career. You know, I mean, I started having my bouffant hair way back in the late 60s. And to write the chapter about it, I just think people would be interested in, you know, because, you know, lacquer was in, I'd never heard of hair lacquer around my way where I lived in those days. And even a hairdryer was considered absolute luxury. And my sister had a hairdryer. And I remember I used to have to put warm water and sugar on my hair and then run up to my sister's about 50 yards away in the middle of winter and blow dry it, you know.
I want to go back in time again a little bit and do a little name word association, if you don't mind, with people
okay.
in your life.
Okay.
When I say someone's name, if you could just kind of say the first thought or memory that comes into mind.
Okay.
Jeff Beck.
Brilliance personified and miserable bugger.
Sam Cooke.
Oh, there wasn't Sam, there'd be no Rod.
Freddie Mercury.
Ah, my dear friend. Miss him.
Ronnie Wood.
I got an email from him today.
Did you?
Yeah. Decided to email me and congratulate me, and it's making him laugh, which makes me happy.
Bob and Elsie Stewart.
Ah, me mum and dad, yeah. loving mum and dad. Everybody should have a mum and dad like that.
What did they tolerate in you?
They let me go into music. You know, you got to understand, in the early 60s, it's not like it is now where every Tom, Dick and Harry's in a band. You know, in those days, it was rather brave, I thought. It was a big, big risk. But they gave me 100% support, as did my whole family, my two brothers and my two sisters. I was so lucky.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
This is the first Christmas album that you've made.
Yes, it is.
It is. Why now?
Well, it's something I've been putting off for quite a while. A lot of people have asked me to do it, but I think, you know, now I've got two small kids. I've got 8 kids altogether, and I've got 2 little ones. One's 6 years of age, and the other one's 1.5 years. So, and I just wanted to sort of do it for them. You know, that's part of the reason. And because I'd done the American Songbook.
This was your previous album.
Yeah, well, there were 5 albums that sold over 20 million of the Great American Songbook. So then this was almost a natural progression to do this one. You know, my voice has gotten a lot better over the last 10 years, especially when it comes to ballads. I don't know if you know, but I had thyroid cancer a few years back.
Yeah.
And had a very serious operation. But I was lucky. I was in and out of hospital in 2 or 3 days, you know. And that sort of lowered my voice a little bit, half a tone.
Mm.
So it gave it a warmth that previously wasn't there.
I imagine you had to work at recapturing your voice, though, after a surgery like that.
Yeah, I did, yeah. It was a good 9 months before the voice came back. It was every day. You know, I'd go in and sing Maggie May, and I'd be able to sing, "Wake up, Maggie," and then my voice would go. So the next day, I'd be able to go in with the band, "Wake up, Maggie, I think I've got something to say to you." And then we'd do line after line until I could sing the whole song, and then I could do 2 songs, and then 20 songs.
Let's listen to a little bit from this new Christmas album. This is a song you did with CeeLo Green. This is called Merry Christmas, Baby. Let's listen.
I said, "Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice. Bought me a diamond ring for Christmas, and I feel like I'm in paradise. All right. Well, I'm feeling mighty fine, y'all. Got my music on the radio."
I gotta say, there's something about those two voices that go together quite nicely.
It's magic, isn't it? Really magic. He's a lovely fella, too. I really like him a lot.
How did the duet with CeeLo come together? Is that just someone you thought, oh, we can make good music?
No, I take no credit for that. It was the wonderful producer, David Foster. It was his idea. He produced the album. He came up with all the other artists. So he takes the credit, not me.
Let's get into the album again. Let's listen to another song.
Play the Michael Bublé one.
You want us to?
Yeah, he's such a lovely fella.
Sleigh bells ring, I am listening. In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland.
Gone away is the bluebird, here to stay. There's a new bird, he sings a love song as we go along, walking in a winter wonderland.
So this was your request. What do you like about this song?
It's so gay. You should see us two when
we do
it.
Do you mean in the happy, joyous way?
Any old way you want, gay. You know, it's just so funny with the two of us singing. We're just so different ends of the rock spectrum, if you want. You know, it's just cute when we get together.
You've talked a lot about your family and your kids. You have 8 kids, you said.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
How has being a dad changed you?
Oh, man, that's a big old question. I mean, especially if it's changed me in the last 7 years, with at my age to have a six-year-old and a 15-month-old.
How old are you now?
67. Mm. And it's really given me a new lease on life. You know, it really is. If there's a fountain of youth, that would be it. My son demands I play soccer with him and after school for an hour every day, running about, kicking the ball with him. And it's really tremendous.
So what's left then?
Happiness, which I've got now. I've had such a wonderful run and such a wonderful life and a wonderful career. I couldn't ask for anything else.
Should old acquaintance be forgot for the sake of old lang syne?
Rod Stewart. His latest album is Merry Christmas, Baby, and you can read an excerpt from Rod, the autobiography, on our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Every year, NPR's book critics and correspondents put together lists of recommendations, their favorite titles from the year across genres. Well, here's reviewer Annalee Neuritz with her top science fiction pick of the year.
2012 was a great year for science fiction that pushed boundaries. Books crossed genres. They veered into fantasy and literature. And political themes are making a comeback, too. A great example is 2312 by Kim Stanley Robinson. It's a space opera, and it's about what happens to humanity once we've conquered the solar system. So what happens? Well, China tries to engineer Venus so humans can live there. The outer planets fight over solar resources, and someone, or something, is destroying Mercury's biggest city. They're hurling millions of tiny meteorites at it, and nobody knows why. 2312 also manages to be a love story and a murder mystery. It follows a performance artist, a diplomat, a detective, and a scientist. They're all investigating what's happening on Mercury. And of course they stumble on something bigger. It's a book that's not ashamed to be utopian, but it feels plausible, too. 2312 explores what it means to be human. And that's something even non-science fiction fans can appreciate.
That was Annalee Neuritz, editor-in-chief of the website io9.com, which covers science fiction. Her pick of the year is 2312 by Kim Stanley Robinson. You can find a complete list of the year's best sci-fi at npr.org/bestbooks.